Okay, my name's Joanne Eastwood, and as you can tell, I'm a nurse. I've had multiple years of critical care experience, actually, and I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing. So this is a shift for me to community-based research. And the title of my project is Cardiac Risk Reduction Intervention for At-Risk Young Black Women. And what we wanted to do was use mHealth, or mobile health, in this population. Stop me at any time for questions. Okay. So I do want to acknowledge I am working with the Wireless Health Institute, computer science. I actually have my own PhD student, which is great. And also I'm working with three churches. And I want to acknowledge them, Faithful Central Bible Church, which is the interventions church. I randomized, it's a randomized controlled trial, and so I randomized by church. So Faithful Central Bible Church is a huge church, but it's in Inglewood, California. And then Central Baptist Church is in Carson, a very small church, and Antioch Missionary Bible Church is in Long Beach. And I also want to recognize Dr. Deborah Mosier. I did a postdoc out at University of Kentucky, and we used heart health education, and her education modules are the antecedents of this study in rural Appalachia. And she was successful with that. And so I will explain what I did to make it a little bit different for here for the UCLA study. Okay, the AHA, or American Heart Association, impact goal for 2020, which is an ambitious goal, is to improve the cardiovascular health of all Americans by 20% while reducing deaths from cardiovascular diseases and strokes by 20%. So I am funded by them in a small clinical research grant for this study. And we did it on a shoestring budget, so it was a group of me, one other person, and three students. Okay, so so we used the theory of planned behavior for this, and this was a theoretical framework for the study. And the motivation to lose weight is different for different cultural groups, and an African American group, being heavy is not as stigmatized as it is for everyone else. So that was something that we had to work with, was different body sizes and views of what their size and shape were. And there is very little evidence as compared with men in women for intervention studies. So that was the motivation for me to go ahead and look at physical activity and what motivates these women to make changes in their physical activity and dietary habits. And Artinian in 2010 did second prevention, an article on prevention, and it was a huge statement. And so I applied most of her principles in this particular study. African Americans also have a higher incidence of diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, stroke, and of course high cholesterol. And it's higher in black women than it is in white women, and it's also higher at a younger age. So what I was looking for was, and the premise for this was, because I was studying women along the line altogether, but what happens is that no one looks at the prevention. No one looks at the 25 to 45-year-old women, and I'm going to show you particular importance in this, but I wanted to highlight prevention in these women, so we wouldn't be looking at them at menopause or at 55 years old and saying, why are they showing up here? Oh, they have a heart attack. We want to do something, of course, with atherosclerosis 20 years ahead of time, because that's when it starts.
Yes.
So,
I think you might be touching on it, because I was wondering about community-based research in general and why you picked the theory of reasonable action, but I think you're going to go into it.
I'm going to go through
right
a lot
now.
Of it. Yeah. Okay. So I picked the churches because it looked like the best way to go, especially when I was out in Kentucky. I looked through the literature, and when you do intervention studies, especially on black women, the church, one, provides a social environment. They are very connected in the church. And also, it provides some social support. And with women, I think social support is very important. If we look at the rehab data, we look that women fall out of cardiac rehab because it's primarily set up for men. And the more social engagement women have, the more likely that they will stay in a program. So that was my motivation a little bit there. Plus, on top of that, when the church leaders sanction something like a study like this, it kind of dispels the past experiences of African Americans in a research study. So once I brought them on board, and that was the neat thing, before I even started, I spoke with the church leaders first and gained their support before I even wrote the grant, actually. And so they have been in it on every step of the way. And so with their support, it's been amazing. I mean, that has been totally priceless. And also social support, as you've seen from the Weight Watcher studies and everything, plays a big role in behavior change. And as I said, the community advisory board, I pull them in, talk to them. I, of course, am not Black, and so I had to be more culturally sensitive and learn a lot about African-American women. I chose them because I wanted to go where I could do the most good. But, of course, I had to learn little things along the way. And they were tiny little things, but they meant a lot to people. I mean, I walked in there as an Italian Catholic girl and said, "So when are masses held?" And they go, "Services. Services." So it was little things like that along the way. And at that point, we were more and more comfortable about, you know, that kind of criticism going back and forth and whatever. But that did me the most good. I cannot tell you, it was priceless. Okay, so the significance. Women's ages 25 to 45. If you look at the numbers for heart disease, you will see them going down. Matter of fact, men in the 2011 and 12 reports were down to like 375,000 per year. Women also are dropping. If you look at the graph by American Heart Association, you'll see a decline. Not as much. It should be a lot more in this day and age, but it is declining. But if you segment off young women, okay, it's actually grown 17% in that. And in this day and age, with all the technology and pharmacological advantages we have now, you wonder why it's growing in that segment. So that was another reason why I chose this group. They also have a higher risk factors than white women. I talked about that before, earlier onset of cardiovascular disease. And when I say cardiovascular disease, I want you to think stroke too. Although that wasn't what this grant was working on, the risk factors are duplicative. And so premature death due to heart disease or stroke in this generation also. And what happens if they have a heart attack young, then they live a less quality of life. They don't usually die, but they live a less quality of life for the rest of their life. And women live longer than men, so that's a long time. So interventions that are gender-based are few and far between, and participation in studies by young Black women, they're either underrepresented or non-existent at all. And there's little evidence of targeted behavior change interventions, as I said, in this population. So the design, how I did it, okay. My premise was to use, my plan was to use 90 young Black women, use 45 intervention and 45 controls. And each of those women had to have at least 2 CVD risk factors, and we'll look at those later on the next chart. Okay, so, and as I said before, I randomized by church, and I used the community. And what I did was take the Appalachian study, which was very successful. Okay, what it was an educational program in the clinics in Appalachia, in the rather poor areas in Kentucky. And those clinics actually did, the nurses went out in Dr. Mosher's study and did education. And then they did the tools and basically the cholesterol panels and hemoglobin A1C and whatever in those community settings. And they were very successful among the Appalachians. They taught them what they did teach them, given the population and the poverty that's there, they taught them self-management tools. So that's what I did. Okay, I took their education, which was an NHLBI slides, and we made up notebooks, and I gave 4 educational sessions to the intervention group, okay, before we did anything with mobile health.
I have a question. I assume yes. In the Appalachian study, the subjects were white, no?
Yes, okay. Most of them, yes. Mostly, yeah. The population there, I think, is only 2% black.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was a white population. I wanted to kind of replicate that study, but in addition, do the wireless health, which was a bigger portion for me. Okay. So these are some of the risk factors. They could have any of these, which a lot of them had several of these, but family history and in the education, we talked to them also about family history because they don't exactly know what these risk factors are, that stroke or a heart attack or chest pain or open heart surgery or whatever. A lot of their parents had died already. This was a sandwich population, the 25 to 45. So they also were taking care of parents. For the most part, a lot of them were very single and mothers. So they were kind of that sandwich generation. So a lot of them had a history of hypertension already. Some of them were already on drugs. Some of them had abnormal lipids. They had never even known what their lipids were. So in part of my outcome measurements is a lipid panel that I did in the field. Okay, diabetes or gestational diabetes, which is getting to be a well-known risk factor for heart disease now. And a lot of them didn't smoke, but a lot of them had a body mass index well over 25. Sedentary lifestyle, I think this was my biggest problem. They live in a not-so-nice neighborhood, so it's not like they can go for a walk at night. So we had to factor all these risk factors in when we did their education. Also, this is the next one. So these two were my biggest barriers right there. A diet high in saturated fat, and low in fruits and vegetables. And it was good because in this area, at least one of the areas, Mrs. Obama had come in and at least assessed the situation a year before I started this study and assessed the situation and got more markets to even have fresh farmers markets to come in and at least have some fresh fruits and vegetables because they weren't even available in the neighborhood.
In this context, what qualifies as moderate activity?
We use moderate activity. What kind of activities
mm-hmm.
did? We explained to the women that if they were walking with a friend and they can talk easily, then that was the least amount. And
absolutely.
Then if they started to get a little winded when they talked or they were going up hills and started to get a little winded, that was more like moderate activity. So we kept it very at the primary level when we spoke with them about what qualified for what.
But I mean, it's like a slow stroll, it doesn't cut it.
No, it does not cut it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, like brisk walking.
Yeah, yeah.
Brisk walking in where they started to like.
Absolutely.
So these were the clinical measures we did at baseline. We did waist, circumference, BMI, blood pressure. We started with CRP, but in the middle of the study, the company decided not to make the CRP, the hsCRP cassettes anymore. So we could no longer do those in the field. We did lipids, and we did them all at baseline, 3 months and 6 months on both groups. We did a food frequency questionnaire, which is put out by the BioScreen, which can detect which, and we did it at all of these have done almost all three times, as you can see. And what you could see from this is food patterns, but not only food patterns, but how they cook it also. So it's a picture program, and I purchased this, and actually they can delineate from this even vitamin D deficiency, nutritional patterns, how they cooked, their cooking patterns over time if they changed. And I heard just anecdotally, because I haven't looked at this data yet, the women, as the third time they came in the intervention group, they said, wow, I remember putting this down, and now look at what I'm doing. So they're really recognizing how they're changing after the education.
Now, that says computer. Is that the only one? So you show them computer? With the
it pictures? Was a computer program. I contracted with them.
Yeah,
and they
I mean, are you showing the respondents that? Because the rest of them were what?
These were all paper and pencil. Everything was paper and pencil that they filled out themselves, except for the literacy one, of course. We asked them those questions. And the demographics. The demographics, basically, they filled out themselves, and then we just reconfirmed that the sheets were full. So we got a family and medical history and reproductive history also. We used all the rest of these. We used the brief symptom inventory, the PHQ-9, medical outcome study, SAS for adherence, but that was modified for the study for cardiac. Quality of life, we did inner heart stress. We used four questions and social support and just at baseline, I did the self-esteem just to see where their self-esteem was.
Is this all the measures that you did? Do you have another slide?
No, that's it.
Okay, because you said theory of planned behavior, so I would think you would have had intentions and barriers to behavior and stuff like that. You weren't trying to actually assess that. That was the basis of... You know,
well, actually, in the education... I'm sorry I didn't bring a notebook. But in the education portion, what we did was assess... they did individualized notebooks. I gave them each individualized notebooks, and it was very primary. It was like red light and green light and yellow light. And so when we taught them about foods, or then there would always be a question, what are your and they kept those privately. So they figured out their own BMI. We figured out their BMI, and then there was a chart so that they can see if they ended up in red, yellow, or green. And then also after each set of pieces of information that we gave them, like using low sodium, what foods are in low sodium, how can you move from this, how can you replace this, we always had questions like, what are your barriers to this, and how can you see yourself being successful? And this was like on every other page. Whenever we finished one thought, we had them identify and write it into their notebooks. And then we met with them later on and talked individually on each of them, what were their goals and where were they were moving towards them.
Joanne, can you go back a slide for a moment? The criteria here are your inclusion criteria. They had to have two. So if you had a family history of CVD, and this diet, which almost everyone has,
yes,
you're in. So you excluded almost nobody.
Almost nobody.
However, within your randomization unit of the church, there might have been very different profiles for sedentary lifestyle, the level of obesity. Did they really look different, the women at the different churches?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The women at family... in Englewood, we're actually heavier. Mm-hmm. I was really desperate to get the control church. I had a huge control church out in Carson, another control church. Mm-hmm. And that pastor got, I don't know what happened, but they just put me off for a year, put me off for another year and a half or whatever. So then I didn't want the controls to be too far away from... Mm-hmm. And I only had a few, so I went to Antioch Church, mm-hmm. which is a much younger church. Mm-hmm. So Lindbreck is helping me correct or control for the age and weight difference because they were younger, mm-hmm. but so we're going to control for that, but they were different. So Okay, so the intervention was the whole heart health approach. And we did one-on-one. We did one-on-one counseling. But we did do education in groups or on one-on-one, depending on how they enrolled. We only completed 40 of them. One girl got lupus. One girl, you know, a couple of people didn't want to continue and use the phones. What we did was try and promote self-management. In other words, you give a man a fish, and he eats for a day, but you give him tools, and he lives for a long time. And what happens is this: we had good outcomes from this because it diffused into the family. And that's what was a great outcome for this study, was that the mom is at the helm, and the kids had to change their diets when the moms did. It was skill-based. They did do individualized goals, and they got feedback. And their unique barriers were addressed. So one-on-one, if someone told me, for example, one lady had four kids, and she said, you know, Joanne, it's great that you tell us to eat five fruits and vegetables a day, but by the time I get done doling out the fruit to the kids in their lunch bags, there's no fruit left for me. And I said things like, well, I was a mom too, and I worked on the playgrounds to help out the teachers, and what I saw was the kids would eat their sandwich or their yogurt or whatever and then throw the fruit in the trash because they wanted to go play. It took too long to peel an orange or eat a whole apple. I says, if you put another snack in there and then save those fruits for night and cut up and make a fruit salad for everyone, then you could all share. I mean, you really had to be creative in how you coach these women, but you could find a way around something. And good things came out of it. Okay, so we gave them heart healthy education. As I said, we used the notebooks. We taught them how to read food labels. They were surprised to see the pictures, you know, the actual cartoons of what size is a half a cup or how much hamburger do you really have to eat, you know, to have enough protein. What was the difference between high fiber and just plain wheat bread as opposed to whole wheat bread? And we really got them looking at the labels, and they were amazed. We also showed them pictures on how to move from whole milk to 2% to 1% so that their family wouldn't notice so much, especially their husbands, notice how to move that. And how to eat fish and what fishes to eat and not the ones that, you know, you buy in fast food. We talked about medication adherence, and we had a whole module on stress management. And we talked to them about stress management because it's, you know, most of the education, even in that prevention article, was to take a yoga class or whatever. These women were not able to take a yoga class, nor could they go out in the evening and take a walk. So we talked about breaking it up into 10-minute periods and what could they do at home or what could they do at the church or what could the church started to provide some Zumba classes and things like that, but not for this particular. They started doing it after I got done, so they wouldn't contaminate my study. But what could they do together, and how could they push a cart further and park further away from the door of a grocery store, you know, and then bring the cart back? We talked about all those things, about getting up from your desk if you worked at a desk and using the bathroom on the next floor instead of using the bathroom on the floor that you're on so that you could do some steps and every step counts. Especially if they were going to wear the phones, because we counted their, we didn't count their steps, but we looked at their activity. So all, and we definitely talked about salt. All of them had no idea the amount of sodium that's in a baked good, anything that's processed. We talked about sugar highs and lows for those that, you know, were on the borderline to diabetes or were diabetic. Not many of them smoked. We only had two smoked and one quit during the study. So this is Reverend Jackie. She helped us, and this is our... This is Connie. We not only gave them the risk reduction, but we did wireless coaching. And how we did that was when they were all done with the 4 weeks, the intervention group was done with the 4 weeks of education, then we gave them an Android phone. And the Wireless Health Institute helped us put in an accelerometer. And the best thing I could find for the women to wear the phone, because this was an additional phone and it had to be worn somewhere on the hip or below the waist, was a Samsonite passport pouch. And so they were, some of the younger girls actually got it under their jeans. But I could get them to wear it most days of the week. So they wore it in waking hours most days of the week. They didn't like to wear it on Sunday because they wear dresses to church on Sunday. Some of them did, some of them didn't. It just depended.
So were they, is there some incentive? Or did you pay them to do this? Or
yes, I paid, well, not a big incentive. They got $25 for each of the three visits, that's all. A $25 Target card for each of the three visits. But no, they were just excited to do it. And so,
because the phones didn't work, right? I mean, they couldn't make calls with those phones. They were just
I cut off the phones, the calls on the phones. Because, yeah, we cut off the phone calls. But they could use the data. So they could text to people and they can go on the internet. But they could not make phone calls on it. Okay, but what happened on the phones, and you'll see in a few minutes. It's hard to put everything in at once. We also gave them a wireless blood pressure monitor, and the Wireless Health Institute helped us with this too. It was a talking blood pressure monitor. They took it home, and on Sunday nights they were taught how to take their blood pressure with their feet flat on the floor, straight in the chair, AHA guidelines. That also came up on their phone, a picture of the, so that could remediate them on how to take it. They all chose to take their blood pressures on Sunday evenings because that was the calmest time for them. So on Sunday evenings, about 7 o'clock, they would take their blood pressure. If they didn't, and they would take it twice, and it would not only show up on the blood pressure monitor, the monitor would tell them what their blood pressure was, and also they pushed a button and it streamed through their phone into our server here at UCLA. And that helped them, they said, to stay in line. You can see, like, after the 4th of July, okay, all of a sudden I saw a spike in the blood pressures because I also had a dashboard where I could see what was going on. Okay, so, like, after the 4th of July, you knew darn well they ate the ketchup, the mustard, the pickles, the potato salad, and everything else, and I saw big spikes in their blood pressure, so then I would text them or call them, and then we talked about what went on and what did you eat and let's get back on track, that type of thing. Also, let's see, the goal of the six-month study, of course, was to look at risk factor reduction and blood pressure and activity and food, and I wanted to see if they would continue with the study, for the feasibility of doing something like this. And so this is basically just a schematic of what all went on. We gave them the equipment, the education, and then we verified what was going on. So that was my dashboard right there. There was, of course, we picked up everything. That's the blood pressure monitor up there. And that's what the phone looks like there. I'll give you a closer look at that. And then there's data storage, and that's here at UCLA. And then we did, every week, we did a progress report. So we printed out and actually looked up, and the other girl that was on my project had a PhD in physical activity. So she took the physical activity piece, I took the blood pressure piece, and we called them. We called them or we text them messages, progress on, great job, you hit so many, you know, points this week. Let's keep going. Let's try and go to 2,000 this time or whatever. Or good job keeping your blood pressure in line. Thanks for, you know, whatever. We sent them daily questions. We sent them weekly questionnaire on the adherence scale. And then we have the three visits.
For all the various outcomes that you were looking at, what was your sense of how much
each of those would change alone or in combination? Or going in, what was your expectation of what the impact that, you know, after 6 months, it could be challenging with diet and exercise, you know, to many of those.
I did not expect a drop in weight, because based on the literature, they don't lose that much weight. But if I could just get them actively in black women, especially young black women, what happens is their HDLs are just so low, and their triglycerides are elevated, and those two things are just on the way to diabetes. You know, if their triglycerides are high, you know they're going to be pre-diabetic. So if I can just make small changes like that, I was going to be happy. But and could get them off the couch. You know, in the evening it was on the couch.
Was there one? Was there like a primary outcome that you were most interested in, or?
I think their lipid panels and their blood pressures are what I would say would be the most. Also taking control of their own health, just raising the awareness that they need to take care of. And what I used to say to them is, if you don't take care of yourself, how are you going to take care of others? Because they had heavy stress, and they had a lot of them got let go of their jobs during the program, and a lot of them were trying to go to school, and like I said, take care of kids and their parents. So this is what our phone looked like. You know, if you looked at like an iPhone, but this was an Android, this is what it looked like, okay? And then they would get reminders also. They're automated reminders that they didn't do their blood pressure or whatever. But these are the three things that they could click on. Okay, so this is what, these were our daily questions. And if you look at them closely, they're, they're actually the adherence scale just over time. So on Monday, they would get two of these questions. Okay, and they would automatically pop up, and if they didn't answer them by about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, they would get a warning message from the thing, just a reminder message, not a warning message. But how many fruits did you eat today, and did you eat low-fat or fat-free dairy products? The clever thing that came out of this was one of the people said to me, one of the women said to me, you know what, Joanne, we get those messages at night and we're happy to get them. I said, you are? Because I thought, you know, that could be a bother. But we made it as simple as possible. I mean, you just clicked on yes or you clicked on four or whatever. But what they liked about it was if they hadn't eaten fruits today, then they would run and go eat two fruits so that they wouldn't have to put down zero or they wouldn't have to put down no. And so this in itself was a motivator to me. At least it got them to do it. And so then this is what they did once a week. On Sunday nights also, we made everything easy so that they could do it all on one night. And that was the night they chose. So we had this questionnaire come in once a week on Sundays.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So you talked a lot about low-fat dairy products.
Yes.
But there's a whole mess of low-fat products out there, low-fat cookies, low-fat this, low-fat that. Did you either address those or do you know if your subjects generalize to those? Because those, in general, can be pretty deadly because the fat is usually replaced with sugar, which, of course, is a lot worse.
I'm sorry I didn't bring the notebook, but we addressed that. Just what low means as far as the government's concerned and just what non-fat means.
No, but I'm talking about in terms of, so like if you're telling people to drink low-fat milk, they might say, well, I guess low-fat is good. When I buy cookies, I'm going to buy low-fat cookies. And when I buy ice cream, I'm going to buy low-fat ice cream. And when I buy, I don't know, what other, I mean, there's so many low-fat products. But the point is, in many of those products, the fat is replaced with sugar.
Right.
Which is, salt may not be that bad compared to sugar. Sugar is dead.
Right. When we talk,
my question is, how did you deal with the fact that there might be that confusion unless you really educated them? I'm really only talking about dairy products. I'm not talking about cookies or ice cream.
Right. Well, we talked about labels altogether. We spent a lot of time. We spent at least 2 hours on just how to read a label and what was low fat and what was non-fat as far as milk was concerned or dairy products. And then we took a look at carbohydrates. Okay, and we taught them to read every piece of the label, and they themselves, and then there were questions in the book so that we knew that they knew what they were talking about, okay, when they looked at the label. So when you look at a label of the sodium, so they knew what was sodium, how many carbohydrates, how much fiber.
It's simple, did you address low fat in
other products? Oh, yes,
yes. Yeah. And you promoted them or you told them?
No. We did not. Matter of fact, we promoted no processed foods whatsoever.
I see. Okay.
We even addressed even cheese that's low fat on it. You know, the packaged cheese that they tend to use in sandwiches. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
that middle question there looks like a yes/no question to me about moderate activity, because you're asking them over the last week, right?
Right. At least 4 days of the last week.
Seems like you would say yes or no to that. Not really a frequency.
Okay. Well, thank you. Sorry. Okay, so this is the part where it says take your blood pressure measurement, and they just push that button. They got remediated as far as how to take your blood pressure. This is what it looked like, and this is what they saw on the phone. As they pushed the button, when they pushed the done, it got transmitted over to the server here at UCLA. And the activity monitor, although they did not see this, this was in the background. And so also we sent them motivational messages during the week. And this is just an example of what we sent them. And then we also wanted to test the self-management intervention to determine whether or not they would stick with it. And I have to tell you, over a six-month period, the people that it has done some good in is the families. One woman had two teenagers who were pretty much ostracized because they were really, really heavy. She bought a lot of fast food. She got on this program, and her 13-year-old boy and her 14-year-old boy lost 20 pounds apiece during the program, which was great. One of the gals whose husband is a deacon at the church, he has been hypertensive since the sixth grade, and it just runs in the family, I guess, but she used an abundance of sodium in all her food. She cooked with sodium. She fried her turkeys and basted them with sodium, with salt before she fried them, and she changed her whole family's diet. She had four young children and a husband, and she wasn't working, and she changed her diet. And her husband, during the program, the first month, went to the physician, and his blood pressure was 200/110. And they immediately sent him to the hospital from the clinic. And after she changed her dietary habits and everything, he came in and thanked us. For the first time since the eighth grade, his blood pressure was 120/80. He had never had that since the eighth grade. So it's amazing what things can do. And we thought those were wonderful. But then there are also other barriers that we faced. And another barrier was one woman tried to buy good fresh fruits and vegetables. Her husband had just lost his job. And she shared with me that she had to give her money that she would ordinarily buy food with, better food for dinner time. She gave it to the kids for lunch, because when they go to school, if they go and they qualify for free lunch tickets, if they went in that line, then kids would make fun of them and bully them all day long. So they begged her for the money for lunch tickets, because they didn't want to be in that line. And so there were barriers, but there were also and challenges. But a lot of the women did very well. And
you said what you did, what you did, that motivational message, and mm-hmm. you also said specific feedback about you're doing well.
Yes.
What did you do if they weren't doing well?
If they weren't doing well, we'd say, what's going on? Or we gave them a phone call. And we gave them a phone call and talked to them about it and said, what's going on? How can we help? You know, everyone had a different problem, so it was it was interesting. Yeah, you know, one girl couldn't go out of her neighborhood. It was terrible. She said, I'd be shot. So, you know, we thought about a jump rope. Things that were cheap that they could get, they could do. Just put on the music, you know, and dance a little. I told them little things for each person, and it just seemed to help. And they liked the attention, and they liked the social support, too. But one girl's, you saw the story about Kiana. She lives, her aunt begged us to take her. Her aunt was in the study, and then she said, can you take one more? And I said, sure. And she worked at Bradley International Terminal, and she worked nights, and there was only junk food around to eat. And she has a 5-year-old daughter, and her blood pressure was out of sight. And she's already on medication. So
I'm interested in how receptive this population was to using this kind of tool. Did you know how many responded to the questionnaires every day, or
okay.
Did some drop out completely? I mean, clearly, when you're getting them through a church, there's a bit of engagement and peer pressure that's above and beyond what you get in a normal random population. So I would expect it would be better than usual. But how good was it?
I would say that we probably enrolled in the intervention group, not enrolled, but screened, about 58 people, 58 women. Maybe three or four of them, they had to drop out because of one got pregnant, you know, she could be in the study, but a couple of other medical conditions and whatever. But there are a few people who, there were two people who just wanted the education, so they came for the education and then said, no, I'm not wearing the phone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of people we had to kind of modulate for because they were already carrying two phones and their work wouldn't allow them to carry another phone that was outside. So we had problems with that. I mean, but there were several people who got tired of using. I had a UCLA student here who never wore the phone. She showed up for the three visits, that's it. I kind of kept her in just as a side, but she had a little girl, she's a single mom, and she just didn't do it. Mm-hmm. She would show up, but that's it, you know? So the people who really were concerned about their health, they really don't have the information. You would be surprised what they don't know. And once they learn about it, in my control group, that's my fear. I had a couple down at Long Beach that thought that they were in a study, but they thought they were in a study to make their heart better when they were in my control group. And I tried to be clear about that when they signed the consent, because I had a separate consent for the control group, and they knew the study was going on. But they go, you're going to be so proud of me, Dr. Eastwood, I lost 10 pounds. Or you're going to be so... and you know, you have to be proud of them, but, yeah. You know.
Yeah. But you do have the data, and we'll get to it sometime, of, you know, for the expectation that every day they would respond to your three questions. You know how many did it every single day of the study and how many kind of phased out.
Right. And we had certain parameters. If they did it over 5 days, we thought it was good. If they answered their daily questionnaires, we have all that data. Mm-hmm. We have every bit of it. And we printed out those progress reports every week of every one of the outcomes. Mm-hmm. You know, every one of the tasks that they had to do. And some people forgot, and they'd text me, oh, I forgot last night, I'm sorry. Or I went to Florida and forgot my phone. My mother was sick, you know, or something like that. So we have all that data. And we have notes, too. We kept notes of, you know, one lady swam rather than she couldn't wear the phone in the water. One lady dropped the phone in the toilet, you know. The one thing, they did not like wearing a separate phone. So what I would do for the next study is actually, one, I wouldn't use an accelerometer. I would get something like this. And we've already tested this against the phone and the accelerometer. Mm-hmm. But what I would do is pay part of their phone bill instead of giving them another phone because it's just too much. Mm-hmm. One girl at the end of the study said to me, I was kind of worried about wearing that phone around my waist with all this about ovarian cancer. I was worried about the radiation because they had to wear it on their right or left hip. Mm-hmm. So there were lots of things we learned, and this was just a feasibility study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are your plans for your next steps?
The next steps?
We have data.
Yes, I have lots of data.
And you haven't analyzed the data yet?
No, I finished this Sunday. Uh-huh. I did 5 controls, and then I have 2 more to do on January 8th, and then I'm done with data collection.
And then you'll be doing
it. Then I'll be doing it. I did some analysis already because I presented at American Heart, but they were just effect sizes on, because at that time I only had a few controls done. But, yeah. What also came out of this, too, was an interesting point probably for the guys is the fact that my PhD student has been all over the world with this study. And he's been all over the world with this study, had abstracts, and he's been to Rhodes, Greece. He's been to Turkey, I think, and he's been to Amsterdam at big conferences on mobile health because we learned quite a few things, like how to diagnose cheating. You know, one gal, she didn't want to get out of bed on a Saturday morning, so she took her phone and just shook it. And we analyzed all that. So, you know, we learned a lot from this study and how to, and then he did something like predictive modeling to see who would be, what characteristics fall into people who would be successful in a program like this. So he's done quite a few papers and abstract presentations and whatever. So we've got a lot to do. Now we're looking at the physical activity data next.
So you had no African American investigators on your team?
No. Well, there's only just me and another.
No, I know, but I just wondered. About
Okay, so Professor Majeed is from the computer science and. He's not African American. Dr. Carol Watson is a cardiologist here.
She's
African American, female. Yeah. And so she was a co-investigator.
Yeah, I was just trying to think about if you were African American, would it be different the interaction? It sounds like you were successful with, you know, getting entree and all that, but did you feel like there would be anything different if, you know, the fact that you're not in the community that you were studying?
You know, I think the relationships I made with people were important, but I can't, on the next study, if I write an R01, I can't be at every one of those sites. I just happened to be the person who had to do the blood, so I was there all the time, and they knew me, and they called me Dr. Joanne. That's what they call me. And, you know, it was a good relationship, but that's because it was a small group, and I got to know them. And that was with the help of the community, you know, like Reverend Jackie is just like, she is just like amazing for me.
The R01, what are you thinking of randomizing, you know, churches, a much larger number of churches? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I'd like to see if this works on a higher. Also, I'd like to see if I couldn't, even a further thought in the future, would be to train people in the churches to give the education and mm-hmm. kind of work through this, kind of a lay worker type of thing.
If you haven't come across it already, there's another, the Heart and Soul study.
Oh, yes, I've seen
it. Baltimore.
Yes.
Diane Becker, another nurse.
Uh-huh.
Was the PI, you know, on that. But they learned quite a bit about
Looking
at African American churches. And it wasn't limited to women, but.
Yeah, the Heart and Soul study. Any other questions? It was an eye-opener. I learned a lot. If you think of anything, just let me know.
As you think about, I mean, the other, you know, group here, you know, Barbara Vickery is a neurologist, right? But you mentioned, you know, stroke, and so NINS, the, you know, neurologic diseases, right? NHLBI for stroke, it has funded her for a big center, and they have interventions in Korean churches and other community settings. And one of the things that they're looking to do that I'm part of helping look at, which actually I learned from Diane Becker. I was a medical student under her.
And
just to, you know, put together, to think about your outcome is, you know, actually putting together, you know, because you're dealing with multiple different components of the intervention and trying to synthesize that into a single outcome like a global risk score. So for primary prevention, of course, you can just use the ASCVD or, you know, the Framingham, right? Mm-hmm. And look at the change in that. And so you can look up Diane Becker's, you know, papers like that. But even for secondary prevention, if you don't have a risk prediction tool that gives you absolute risk, you can still multiply different, you know, changes in blood pressure, lipids, and whatnot, and, mm-hmm. and predict what the relative reduction would be of these multiple interventions combined instead of looking at them separately.
Oh,
so then you're likely to have a better. And so we're in the process of, you know, developing that. There's another group that already, you know, sort of proposed that as an idea in health affairs a couple of years ago. But I think, you know, for these community interventions in particular, there's not going to be enough money, right, to power your intervention for any hard outcomes. You're not going to be looking at the number of strokes or heart attacks or anything like that.
Right.
So you have to look at, you know, some other surrogate. And it very much depends, you know, it's important how you get there. So you have to use, you know, evidence-based, you know, intervention. And question, how, you know, can you make other assumptions? Because unfortunately, diet and exercise doesn't have RCT-supported evidence, actually, you know, looking at hard outcomes, you know, mm-hmm. to support it.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
I'm glad that Adam brought up. Do you know who Barbara Vickrey is?
I think...
Martin's.
I'm glad he brought it up because I actually was going to talk to you about this after listening to her. She's got this big center, as Adam said. It has a number of projects. It also has an education and training core. And every year we select two or three fellows to be part of that core, and you know, there's certain things we offer those fellows. Anyway, I'm the director of the education and training core. And I wonder if it would be okay for me to contact you, because I'd love to talk to you about whether any of your students would be interested in being one of our fellows. We're dying to have a nursing student at any level, but doctoral level or master's level is probably the most appropriate.
Uh-huh.
Undergraduate, I think it would be harder because of their commitments with classes and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they have to be involved in research.
Uh-huh.
But in any event, we would love to have a student from the nursing school be one of our fellows. And so, and this is exactly the right topic. And so I wonder if I could just send you an email.
Sure.
My name is Jose Esparce.
Okay.
And then maybe we can set up a time to either meet or just talk on the phone. I can tell you about the program, and then you can tell me if you think that it would be something that any of your students would want to do.
Okay.
Okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks very much, and thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.